welcome. I'm Marisa Dima, and this is Mixed Reality in Culture. Today, discussion will evolve around the challenges and future routes to co-designing augmented reality experiences with Indigenous communities. It is a topic that I am very much researching right now, and I have the pleasure to talk about it today with someone who is already doing it, Dr. Kai Lukoff. Hi, Kai, and welcome to the podcast.
Hi, Marisa. It's a pleasure to be here.
Dr. Kai Lukoff is an assistant professor at Santa Clara University, leading the Human-Computer Interaction Lab in the Department of Computer Science and Engineering. He uses human-centered methods to research, design, and develop technologies with social impact. His research investigates how digital interfaces impact user experience and the sense of agency, and he has conducted field experiments to evaluate how redesigned features of social media applications, including Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, impact digital well-being metrics. Additionally, he is collaborating with Native American partners on a new interdisciplinary project to create an augmented reality tour showcasing the past, present, and future of the Ohlon tribe on Santa Clara University campus. And Kai, I will start with this project, of course, and I will ask you to tell me a bit more about what you're doing through it.
Absolutely. So one of the opportunities that's very exciting for me since joining the faculty at Santa Clara University a year and a half ago is that our university campus is not only an educational site, but also a cultural heritage site. That is, when the Spanish colonized California in the 1700s, they established a series of missions up and down the coast of California. And Mission Santa Clara, which sits at the center of our campus and is still to this day a functional Roman Catholic church, is one of them. And so as a result, we have a lot of interest on our campus and from tourists who come, about 100,000 per year, to see this Spanish mission history. Now, of course, there's actually a history that predates that by thousands of years, and that's that the Ohlone Native American people have lived and stewarded these lands for that time and are still here today. And so when I joined, we decided that there was an opportunity to create a story through augmented reality that shares that perspective of the Ohlone Native American people on this land.
Great. And so the design process, I want to go to the design process more because I know that you designed it together with them, but I want to ask a little bit about how did you set up the whole project and how did you decide to do co-design and what were the initial steps to approach them and, you know, describe the project and what was their, you know, their response? Is it a little bit like the, let's say, the pre-production process?
That's so important because this is not a project that in the last year and a half has happened in isolation. Rather, it's been part of a longstanding engagement with the Ohlone people. So this is an interdisciplinary collaboration between myself as a faculty in computer science and faculty in anthropology, English, arts, and of course, co-designed together with the Muekma Ohlone Native American tribe. Now, the anthropologist on this project, Lee Penich, has been working with the tribe for the better part of a decade and with California Indians in this region for two decades or so. And the university also has a longstanding relationship with the tribe so that we have other initiatives underway, such as running a youth summer camp for Ohlone youth and a scholarship for Ohlone to attend the university. So for our Ohlone partners then, this project is more like one in a portfolio of different collaborative projects that we're working on together rather than something that just arose out of the blue and got started a year or so ago. Most directly, this project grew out of an effort that Lee Panitch, the anthropologist I mentioned, as well as Amy Luke, professor of English, started, where they were trying to uncover these stories of our campus and its land that have gone unrecognized. And they created a Google Earth tour that was viewable on the web, that people could, you know, see the satellite view of our campus and then jump around to different sites and learn the history and contemporary interpretation of those sites by from the perspective of Ohlone people. And after they completed that work, they realized, hey, there could be an opportunity to also experience this in person on site. And when I joined, I thought, hey, this is something that we could turn into being not just kind of something that we would outsource to a design consultancy, but rather that myself and the students in my lab, who are amazing, could work on and co-design together with all of the other wonderful partners that we have in this project, and turn it also into a project of some research import in the field of human-computer interaction.
So I guess the being within, like working within community from the perspective of the university so long definitely helped. Was that the first digital project that happened with the Indigenous community, or were others before that?
Good question. So the Google Earth tour certainly was, I think, the first that was this kind of digital space-based storytelling project. There previously had been a, you know, walking tour, physical walking tour that had been conducted at times. And there've also been separate projects, for example, a display in the campus museum with a digital display that guides visitors through some of the different artifacts that have been discovered on campus, and some of the stories of the individuals who lived on campus. So those are also digital projects too.
Mm-hmm. And were they co-designed as well?
Yes, those have all been co-designed together with Mwekma, the particular Native American group of Ohlone that we've been working with, who are based in this region.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so in this current project then, so tell me a little bit about how this co-design process started. And maybe can I ask a bit about the demographics as well of the people from the community that were involved?
Yes. So I feel very fortunate that because Lee and Amy in particular had this longstanding relationship with tribal members and tribal leaders, we were able to get this project started very quickly. And there was a lot of existing trust that and really infrastructure that the project was able to build it on. And I mean that in terms of everything from the chairwoman of the tribe, who isn't really involved on a day-to-day project, but knows all of the actors who are, was comfortable giving this project her blessing and does occasionally weigh in, to there being an infrastructure in place for compensation for the expert knowledge that our partners provide here. Because it does sometimes go a little bit outside of the bounds of, you know, how payments are usually made at our university, because they're hired as expert consultants. And, you know, those are all processes that we've established over the years through prior collaboration with our partners on this project. And so most directly involved have been a former tribal vice chairman of the tribe, Monica Arellano, and also Gloria Gomez, who's a senior member of the tribe, then also, interestingly, of late, we've gotten a number of youth involved in the project as well, who are oftentimes more hands-on in the technology and design aspects of the experience Whereas the elders have more of the experience with the culture and the stories and the music.
Okay, yeah. Oh, well, actually, I wanted to comment on like offering compensation is so important. So glad to hear, yes. So before, I guess I want to ask a few more questions about the methods, but maybe before we go more in depth and for the listeners, can you give like an overview of what the project was about and what, you know, what was the final outcome as well?
Yeah, so it's still very much in progress, but we have some initial results that I can report on, or initial progress. And so what the experience is a web-based augmented reality experience in which you can scan a QR code or jump open up a URL directly on your phone. And when you're on our campus, then the map view will direct you towards one of three different stops on the tour that we currently have created. And the first one, for example, is the site of a historical Ohlone village, Tamien. And at that site, when you enter the AR mode, you will see the tule reed houses that native people have lived in for many thousands of years in this region. The whole region was originally a marsh, which is now largely sort of filled in or paved over. And in those marshes were lots of reeds, and those were what were used to construct temporary settlements by the native people here. And so you would get a picture into what that would look like, accompanied by narration from one of our native partners describing how the tribe would move with the seasons, what food sources they would look for, what cultural practices would occur in the village. And then there would be two other stops as well, one at the Mission Santa Clara, the Catholic Church at the center of our campus itself. And for that one, we have names in the sky of the thousands of Ohlone people who lived and died at the mission, because oftentimes that site is seen as a Catholic site, which it is too, of course. But in reality, there are often two or so Spanish missionaries and hundreds of native people. And so it can also be seen very much as a native site. And so that's what we want to foreground by showing the native Chochenyo language names of Ohlone people in the sky surrounding the mission. And then finally, we have another stop, which is more focused on the present, the current and ongoing existence of Ohlone people in this region, which displays the wonderful cultural traditions of the powwow, a gathering of Native American tribes, which happens every spring on our campus at a particular site. And that's where then also this content is surfaced. And so with each of these, we really wanted to draw a strong connection to this why here question. Why this piece of land? Why this location? Is this story being told? And explore how we could connect story to the land itself, which is, of course, also a longstanding tradition in Native storytelling.
And do you connect it also with later, like historical events, or with the current, you know, the current structure that is there and its connection through the land and the history?
So that's something we're planning to do. We currently have these three stops, and we've done a bunch of brainstorming and envisioning together with the tribe, and are hoping to, over time, develop this out into something more like 15 stops. We launched the first three as part of Indigenous Peoples Day in the fall of 2023, and are planning to launch a full public version in a couple of months here in May 2024. But certainly more of that connection throughout time of the past, present, and future visions of how Ohlone could be recognized and celebrated on our campus is very much part of that conversation.
That's the mission of the project. Great. So you said you designed together with them. So how is this going? How do you structure it? And what are, as always, I'm always asking this question, the issues and the opportunities that you have found with the co-designing with Indigenous communities?
Yeah, that's so critical. We've been drawing largely on the design justice approach as articulated by Sasha Costanza Schock, a scholar, activist, and designer at MIT, and the larger Design Justice Network. And one of the principles there is really drawn from disability advocacy, and it's this nothing about us without us. And so collaborating with community is everything for this project. And so to actually instantiate that, we have started with a series of workshops about what were the goals that the tribe wanted to get out of this collaboration and project. And so one of the things that really came to the fore through that process was that we had initially envisioned more of a historical accounting of some of the injustices against the tribe and some of the unrecognized history on our campus. And the feedback that we received was, that's good, but we also want to emphasize that we are not just a historical peoples, but rather we are a contemporary people. We have always been here, we are still here, and we will always be here. And so that really led us to shift the focus slightly towards also emphasizing this present and future piece of the story, as, for example, with that powwow stop, which shows contemporary practices of Native American traditions on our campus. And so after doing these initial workshops and setting this kind of vision for what the project of, as a whole could achieve, we then have done further, I would say, monthly calls together with tribal leaders to get feedback on the design direction, everything from sort of the visual language that we use in the app to, is this the right stop? And then also more one-off sort of as needed interactions, I would say, where, for example, we booked a recording studio and invited and had a wonderful collection of tribal elders and tribal leaders come and sing some of their traditional songs. And that material then could be incorporated into some of the tour stops, as well as just be actually archival material for them to use as they see fit. And then also been weaving it into some of those other collaborative enterprises or collaborative projects that I've discussed. So for example, since we have a Ohlone youth camp, every summer we welcome about 15 Ohlone youth to our campus, and we're trying to think about, like, is there something here where the Ohlone youth could also co-create a augmented reality stop for the tour based on their experience of reviving and learning and passing on Ohlone culture through that experience. So those are all sort of vectors of interaction that very much have informed the way that we're then creating this process.
Mm-hmm. So to what extent does the community lead the project? And I guess it's not like a research project per se. It's more of a project which the final output kind of drives what is, you know, what is the process, right? Or do you have a research question?
I would say it's really a project where we've started first and foremost as this being a social impact project for members of the tribe to be able to see, members of our campus community to be able to see, as well as some of those 100,000 or so mission tourists who come through our area to see, by telling them, hey, look, you might have come for the Spanish mission history, but here's a QR code and you can see this other perspective on our history from the perspective of the Native American tribe that's lived here. And then as part of that, of course, my incentive as a professor and pressure to within the academic system is also to publish research. And so I've been seeing, like, are there pieces of this where I can carve off, or where there's, you know, where it naturally creates kind of interesting research contributions for the field of human computer interaction. And so one of those pieces is actually this co-design question. So within co-design, then we're thinking about how can we work together with communities to envision these augmented reality experiences? And one of the methods that we've been experimenting with, and would love to hear your feedback on, is actually what we're tentatively terming landmark-based affinity diagramming. So affinity diagramming, with all the post-it notes being placed and clustered in different themes, is a common method within user research and design. And we're thinking about how can we tie this to the land? And so we printed out a massive 6-foot by 10-foot map of our campus, which is really our canvas for this work. And then we had our tribal collaborators write down on one color of sticky notes or post-it notes the stories and messages that they wanted to communicate. And then on another, all of the media assets that they had available or could make available to tell those stories. And then we placed those sticky notes on top of this map so that we could really envision what does it look like as we move towards 20 or so stops on this augmented reality tour? Where are they going to be located? What are the stories we want to tell at each site? And what are the assets that we can display to communicate that story? And so that then is potentially a generalizable method that people or folks at other sites working on cultural heritage or social justice stories could reuse if we're able to document it and refine that as a approach to creating augmented reality experiences.
I have one question that I actually now, I can do it in two different questions. The first one is, because you mentioned, of course, the QR codes and the AR and the also the need of a lot of 3D models and content. Does your discipline of human-computer interaction and the way that things are designed and how they are as well, like the technology use, for example, does it kind of blend within this co-design approach to do the youth or anyone really that participates from the community, from the tribe, do they learn, for example, how things work, like in a sense, or do they have some skills that they contribute, say if you have someone who does 3D modeling? Like, is there a kind of a blending between the skills, let's say?
So one of the principles of the design justice movement is to share design knowledge and tools with communities. And we've really taken that to heart and been lucky that, particularly as I mentioned, amongst the tribal youth, there's a real interest in how is this being created. And so we've been working with a 12-year-old tribal member who has really been giving us involved on a biweekly basis now in our design process to observe and then over time work towards creating some of these artifacts and stories herself. And we're looking to hopefully with the summer youth camp this year, recruit more Ohlone youth who are interested in participating and making that sort of a regular standing co-design woven throughout the entire experience of this creation process, where we can both transfer knowledge as well as gain knowledge by drawing upon the expert cultural expertise and social storytelling and other skills that these youth can bring to bear. And we found that they're just more available, perhaps, getting to some of the challenges with interacting with partners on a project like this, as compared to some of the elders, for example. And oftentimes, frankly, more interested in the tech and design aspects of it that are relevant to, in particular, my field of human-computer interaction. So that's been very exciting as a new collaboration or new avenue for collaboration.
That's great. It's great to hear. And I mean, it has been also my approach to this. In similar to the design justice framework, I follow very much a participatory action research, which is like same, but written from a different perspective, maybe. And I think when you work with indigenous communities, I suppose you've come across the self-determination concept that you equip the communities as well with the tools to do research themselves. So my second kind of like question, which relates to this, is with regards to the academic rigor. And that's why I wanted to establish first whether there is a research angle on the project. So there is many times, not from us, but like where, if you are writing this project, for example, for a grant, for an external funder, it often, this depending of course who the funder is, obviously, but sometimes it might be like when you say that the research, the end users, say, so would be like indigenous communities or any kind of communities, you will let them have like the research lead on this because it is their knowledge, their practices, their kind of embodied as well, heritage. So in projects like this, they have to take the lead. Occasionally, when you write these things up, it might seem to people, like to reviewers, to other reviewers, for example, or to the funding bodies, that this is not academic rigorously, this research. So I wanted to ask you your opinion on that, and whether this happened with this project, or is the funding, where is the funding from? But also like in the general landscape of these projects, and if you have discussed with other HCI researchers or researchers from other disciplines, maybe your collaborators from anthropology, if these are kind of discussions that are going around, because they definitely are in the UK academic landscape.
So far, our funding has come from an internal grant at our university, specifically for interdisciplinary collaborations. And our collaboration, of course, with faculty from computer science, anthropology, English, and art is very interdisciplinary. And so we've been lucky to receive that in the form of kind of initial funding to get the project off the ground. We also have applied to funding from the National Endowment for the Humanities, which is in the United States the largest funder for humanities research, and received very positive reviews, but were ultimately rejected. The concerns, though, were not so much about rigor in the way that it's only an N of one site. There were some other issues that I think we're going to address and reapply with then in the near future. In my area of human-computer interaction, we haven't applied for funding. Bodies like the National Science Foundation on that side yet. I suspect they might want to see more focus on the technical sides of the project. That, to be honest, might not align with some of the goals of the project. So I think some of the questions there that are related, but slightly different from the specific goals that the tribe would have in mind here, would be, how do you sustain, for example, a augmented reality tour experience over multiple years and bring in, tour groups and students and tourists to all kind of engage with this equipment in a compelling way. So I can imagine those as potential sort of research questions that might get funded in my field, but that are perhaps less in line with some of the goals of the project. So we'd like to focus more specifically then on some of the socio-technical aspects of this work that might be more amenable to funders that are more in line with the specific goals of this project so far. And so that's been the National Endowment for Humanities, and then we're also talking with some foundations. So I suppose it's a little bit TBD. We have published some sort of initial work in my community, the CHI Conference on Human-Computer Interaction, which is the biggest conference in my field, in the form of, the workshop submission included some elements of the project that we're working on, and that was warmly received, as well as a video showcase of the work. And then hopefully this coming year, we will actually write up some of the co-design methods as a research contribution in a full-length paper. And would love to report back on that in the future, how that goes.
All right, so the National Endowment of the Humanities didn't say anything about the rigorousness of the method then. Because is no matter if the focus is on the technical or on the more like creative or arts and humanities side, I think both funders could, I'm not sure how it is viewed to do co-design, because really doing co-design with communities embraces a lot of like the chaotic process that can form. So in a sense, in my mind, you don't have a specific result that, you know, you can wish for. So you can say, and these are going to be the outcomes, or actually the outputs even more, you know, to be more precise, because outcomes in terms of knowledge and information, you know, you can of course have a variety, but in a sense, maybe you can say, you know, just an example, that I want to create like an augmented reality game with the communities, but then in the end, as you go through the process of designing with them, you might end up with something that might not be augmented reality game, just as an example, because for multiple reasons. So I guess I'm interested to know to what extent US funders embrace this risk.
So one of the ways that I think we've managed that is that we've, through the experience of working together on these three initial stops, arrived at a format of storytelling that I think we're relatively comfortable with. There's kind of a template of like, we're going to have a story and message, we're going to have some digital assets, and it's going to be located at a specific site of meaning on our campus. And so that it answers this kind of why here question. Why am I standing here with my phone awkwardly outstretched? And maybe in a number of years, it'll be, you know, a headset. But why am I here doing this experience here now? And it does have some structure. So we don't want these experiences to be, you know, 10 minutes, because we found that that wears on the patience and the capabilities of the technology. There are certain constraints in terms of what we can display at a particular site, but it also is pretty open-ended in that the specific story that could be told there ranges widely. And so when we so far have pitched this project in funding proposals, we do sort of fill in the blank for like, what are these future stops going to look like? And we say that we're going to tell this particular story, which does come out of, you know, the envisioning workshops that we've done together with the tribe. However, in practice, what we found is that when we actually go to develop that particular stop, the story and the assets that are shared there can change wildly, which is appropriate because, you know, it should align with the story that the tribe wants to tell, and through the process of creation discovers that they want to tell. And at least so far, that hasn't been an issue. So long as we're sort of still sharing some of the stories that want to be told here, that seems to align with the objectives that funders have. But, you know, when we pitch the project, we do share sort of more specific stories than perhaps we could even know at that point in time, because as a funder, you have to capture a little bit of their imagination, or that you have a vision for how this is all going to work out. And so it can't just be like, and we have another 12 stops or 17 stops that we're going to do. And it's just going to be a totally co-designed experience. So fill in the blank yourself. Instead, we try and fill in some of those blanks of what it could be, and then subject to change in our design co-design process.
Yeah, I think it's important to manage to have a small case study first with the money from the university. And this, I think, highlights how important it is for universities to be quite open on their different research processes, as they are a bit more informed and they can be more agile than, until it comes to funders. So I think it's quite important to be able to experiment first in this way. And I think, yes, you were very lucky to have this money from the university as well. And it's been the case here as well, like universities are more embracing experimentation and risk. So that's, that's how you also advance knowledge in design methodologies or like collaborative methodologies. I have one last question, and that's again about funding. And this is again about the hot topics of discussion, which has to do with the approach to the ethical framework with which you do work with communities. And I don't know how it is in the US, but in the UK, we have to, when you ask for money, especially you have to write a lot of details on how you're going to manage the data, personal data from the people who you will work with. And the more co-design you do, the more, the bigger the amount of personal data that is involved. And of course, when we work together with communities, in the same sense that they have a kind of researcher role in the project, they should also be able to advise or be part of the debate of how the data is collected and managed. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on this. How is this handled now? And here, for example, in the UK, it's very much about keeping everything in a secure server at the university. And sometimes even collaborators from other universities cannot access those. And that you keep them for a few years, and then they're being destroyed. What about if the people from the collaborators from the indigenous communities don't want this to be kept at all, or don't even want them to be shared anonymously in data sets or whatever? And of course, some research is more qualitative, so maybe data sets are not that important, but some research is quantitative, so maybe data sets can help in the future other the research, which can be made publicly but in an anonymized way, can help other researchers kind of replicate things or get more results. So yeah, I wanted to ask, within that premise, how is this being handled in your field and in your experience so far?
Yeah, so in the United States, for those national funding organizations, they also require a data management plan. And our approach has really been that ownership of any of the stories, assets, that are created through this process reside with the tribe. And so in practice, then we do have a shared folder that's secured on our university infrastructure that both of us have access to, but that the tribe could delete content from as they chose, and also reuse content, which has been an important use case for them. Because, for example, when we brought in tribal members for that recording session, they recorded a number of songs and since have reused them, for example, when they appeared at a local soccer stadium to hear their music played over the loudspeakers there, which was for them a powerful experience and is exactly right. We want to also create assets that can be reused as they see fit beyond the particular augmented reality experience that we're creating here. And then beyond that, anytime that we publish or present this work, we also just double check with them that, this is going to go into a publication here in the ACM Digital Library. So it would be very difficult for us to remove it, for instance, in the future, and want to make sure that this content is okay with you. Anything in the tour itself, since it's a tour that we're designing and have more direct access over, we could remove at a more of a moment's notice if needed. And that's something that the tribe would very much reserve the right to do. So far, it hasn't come up, But I think that's been part of also going through this co-design process so that we have these goals that are shared. We have the design of each stop, which gets approved. The stop itself is narrated by tribal members. And so that mitigates some of the risk of, you know, putting content out there that they wouldn't want to see in the world. And they do have, you know, content that is confidential or private. And so they wouldn't, for example, want to share a lot about their burial practices in one of these tour stops and some other topics. So that's something that we very much want to respect, because at the end of the day, of course, these are their stories and their songs, and needs to align with their values and mission.
Great. That's great. What do you think, what would you say from all this, you know, experience you've had so far, that is the most important thing you would advise people who want to do, especially designers who want to do work with indigenous communities and co-design? This is the most important one, just one. If you were to think of only one.
Not over-promising. And so we've had to be very upfront about some of the limitations of our team and the technology. So for instance, I described that we had that one stop on our tour of Tamian Village, and we initially sort of co-designed this vision of a village in which you would not have only the tule reed houses, but also coyote and children wandering about, and a stream or river flowing through the village. And when we started developing, we realized that was beyond what our team was capable in terms of modeling, and beyond probably what a web-based AR experience, we're building on the Niantic 8th Wall experience, which also powers Pokemon Go, but beyond what that was capable of powering at this moment in time. And so being very upfront about what we're able to achieve through this medium at present has been a very valuable sort of process of learning through the creation of these first three stops so far.
Excellent. Guy, thank you so much for this wonderful discussion.
Thank you so much, Marisa. It was a real pleasure.
And to you, my listeners, I will see you in next episode. Until then, take care.